Okay, good morning. So this is Bio 231, and we're talking about muscles. And let's see, what else is happening? Next week on Monday, you have a test on bones and joints, right? No muscles, although we're going to continue with muscles today. Muscles won't be on the test, but it will be on your third test coming up. So does anybody have any questions on bones? What's a joint that you have to know? Forwards and backwards. The knee joint, that's right. Okay, yeah, so make sure you know that. Okay, well, let's continue on with muscles. Last time we talked about nomenclature a lot by how we can classify muscles by either being fusiform. What's a fusiform shape? What's fusiform mean? You guys are thinking of bones probably too much. Okay, a fusiform is pointy. Right, it's going to be two sharp ends, sort of like a porpoise or a whale or something. Okay, the strap-like muscle is going to have two blunt ends. There's a deltoid muscle because it's triangular shape. Orbicularis, what kind of muscle is an orbicularis? It's circular. It's a circular skeletal muscle. And don't forget, what's the only thing that you actually can control voluntarily in your body? It's skeletal muscle, which is what we're talking about today. Okay, let's see, what else did we cover last time? Oh, muscle interactions. That's right. Muscles that work together to perform a certain kind of motion are what we call synergists. And I gave you one example of synergist muscles in the anterior arm. Can anybody remember the two muscles that work together to perform the same motion, namely flexion of the forearm? What muscles produce flexion of the forearm? That's the biceps brachii, and then the deep muscle is the brachialis. Biceps brachii and brachialis. And the brachialis is actually the stronger of the two, the more important of the two in that particular motion. And so since it's the more important of those two muscles, we also then designate the brachialis as the prime mover as well. It's the prime mover for that particular motion. I don't know if your book makes a big point of that or not, but the brachialis is. All right, and then the most important concept of this class is what? I don't know if I think I mentioned it last time, is antagonism. Okay, to appreciate antagonism and how important that is in your body. And muscles that work in opposition to each other are what we call antagonistic muscles. And generally speaking, before you took this class, what was your connotation of antagonism? Was it good or bad? Bad, yeah, because who wants to be around antagonistic people all the time, right? So, but in terms of control systems, in terms of anatomy and physiology, antagonism is a very important thing because it provides two things for your body. It provides for control and balance, precise control and balance. So, what are two muscles that we mentioned that are antagonistic to each other, that perform an opposite motion? Yeah, and in terms of forearm motion, either flexion, okay, produced by the biceps or the brachialis, the biceps brachii, because that's in the arm, or extension would be produced by the triceps brachii. All right, and it's the interaction of those two muscles that allow you to position your index finger, for instance, exactly in a position in space, exactly and precisely. So if you only had a biceps muscle, every time it would contract, right, you would just be punching and poking yourself in the eye, for instance. Okay. But because of the triceps brachii, you can put your finger anywhere in space that you want. So you have precise control. And I'll talk about balance a little bit later on. So those are the two important reasons. All right, then we talked about how we like to name muscles sometimes by their location in the body, like biceps brachii, you know that is in the arm. You have another biceps, but it's not a brachii, it's a biceps femoris, right? So that's going to be in your thigh. But again, we can also name a muscle by the number of origins that it has to help us understand anatomy. So again, the biceps, in every case, whether it's the biceps brachii or biceps femoris, it's going to have two origins. Okay. Okay, and then this probably right here is the easiest thing that you can use to figure out actions on muscles. All right, and this is where we left off last time. So for instance, all muscles in the anterior neck, when these contract, remember when a muscle is excited, it can't push, it can only do what? It can only pull. It can only shorten. And when it shortens, it's going to pull on something. Okay. So the muscles in the anterior neck are going to pull on something, right? And if they're in the anterior, they're going to connect bones in some anterior part of your trunk and your anterior head. And when those muscles contract, that's going to flex the cervical spine or vertebral column. We call that flexion. Anterior neck. The posterior neck, since it's in an opposite part of your body compared to the anterior cervical region, all right, these are going to do what? These are going to extend. So all of those in the back are going to extend. All right, the same thing for the trunk. Anterior trunk is going to flex the vertebral column. Posterior trunk are going to extend the vertebral column. And when we go to the appendages, all right, for instance, all of these anterior muscles in the brachium are going to flex the forearm. The posterior arm is going to extend. Anterior forearm, lots of muscles here to know. These are all going to flex either the wrist or flex the digits. All right, so these are flexors. Posterior forearm, these are all going to be extensors. Right, so you don't have to necessarily memorize every particular motion. You just have to know about where these muscles are in your body. And a lot of times, in the name of the muscle, it tells you what the location is. And sometimes it tells you what the origin and insertion is. So those are things you don't have to memorize. All right, so your book kind of goes over this a little bit. Personally, I find this very helpful. Your book goes over it a little bit. I said the book kind of goes over it a little bit. Where's this slide at? Okay, I don't know. It's behind this window. I can't bring it forward. Okay, here it is. I don't know why I can't hide that window. All right, I'll slide it out of the way. All right, so here is a diagram, all right, that shows an upper appendage and a lower appendage. And in the posterior arm, for instance, the triceps brachii right here, that's an extensor. All these muscles that we're going to look at, actually the three heads of the triceps, all of these are going to be extensors. All right, but in the anterior arm, these are all going to be flexors. And then if we go to the forearm, again, these are going to be flexors, like the flexor carpi ulnaris. Who could tell me where this flexor carpi ulnaris is and what the motion is? It's going to be a flexor of what particular part of your body? Well, flexors of the forearm are in the anterior arm, okay, but where the flexor carpi ulnaris, all right, because it's ulnaris, you know it's in your forearm, and it's going to be what, the medial side over here. And carpi, what does carpi tell you? It's a flexor of the wrist, for instance, or the carpal bones. Okay, so it's going to be anterior forearm, medial side, flexor for the wrist, but not the digits, right? Because that would be a digitorum, flexor digitorum kind of muscle. Okay. All right, and extensors then are going to be in the posterior forearm, extensors of the wrist as well as the digits. Okay. So let's go to the lower appendage. We have extensors in the anterior thigh, like the quadriceps femoris. These are extensors, so what's extension of the thigh? Extension of the leg. Extension across the knee. Okay, there's going to be this motion, a kicking motion. And so the quadriceps contract. And the tibialis anterior muscle right here, okay, are going to, doesn't really say extensors. What is that motion when you lift your toes up off the ground? We call that dorsiflexion, right? So these are dorsiflexors in the anterior leg here. And the posterior leg, these are going to be plantar flexors, for instance, like the gastrocnemius. Okay, and now the muscles of the posterior thigh, instead of extension of the leg, these are going to be flexion of the leg. So flexion of the leg is, if you're in anatomical position, bringing your heel up toward your buttocks like that. That's flexion of the leg. Extension would be putting your foot back down. All right, so by body compartment is the easiest way to understand muscle action. Because if you know one body compartment correctly, then if you go to the opposite body compartment, what can you tell me what the action is going to be? It's going to be antagonistic, right? It's going to be the opposite motion. All right, so that's the easiest thing to see right there. I think I'm asking my computer to do too much here, but all right, so let's look at some, first off, some muscles of the head, namely the occipital frontalis. And this is, just happens to be one of those names of muscles where it tells you what the origin and insertion is. So what is the origin of the occipital frontalis? It's the occipital bone, okay? And what does the origin mean? More movable or less movable end? It's the less movable end, that's right. So when this muscle contracts, the occipital bone doesn't move at all. All right, and then according to the terminology right here, where is the insertion? Is the frontalis or frontal bone, but it actually doesn't insert into that bone, it inserts into connective tissue around the eyebrows. Okay, because if it inserted into the frontal bone and the muscle contract, no bone would move because the frontal bone is connected to the occipital bone via the parietal bone, and those are sutural joints. They're immovable. Oh, what kind of joint is an immovable joint? It is, starts with a what? An S. Starts with an S. Syndesmosis. Syndesmosis, okay, is an immovable joint. So this muscle attaches to the skin of the eyebrows, right? And the insertion is what? The more movable end of that particular muscle. So when that muscle contracts, it elevates the eyebrows. So where do we have a picture of occipital frontalis? Well, I'm going to zoom into this right here. Okay, so here is the occipital frontalis muscle. And you can see that it actually has two parts to it. It has an occipital belly and it has a frontal belly over here. Sometimes some books call this the occipitalis. Some books call this the frontalis. And the frontalis and occipitalis are connected by this broad, flat, tendinous sheath that's right on the top of your head. And a broad, flat, tendinous sheath is what we call an aponeurosia. We have a number of aponeurosia in our bodies, okay, and they sort of act like tendons, tendinous sheets, but they're broad and very, very flat. So right on the top of your head, you don't have any muscle, right? It's just a broad, flat tendinous sheath. So this muscle goes by a number of different names, occipital frontalis, and since it is on top of your head, sometimes it's referred to as the epicranius. But I like to call it the occipital frontalis because of nomenclature. It's a nice teaching model for how to name muscles. Okay. So, and you can see it's actually made up of two separate muscles if you really look at it. Okay. Muscles of the neck, namely the sternocleidomastoid. Again, this is a nice muscle because when you just look at the name for the first time, right, it probably is very mysterious, but once you understand how to read muscle names, it's what? It's really handy that we name muscles sometimes by their origin and insertion. So what's the origin of this muscle right here, just by looking at the name? It's the sternum and the clavicle. That's what clido means, sternum and the clavicle. And the insertion is the mastoid process of the temporal bone. And it's really good you guys are getting your practicum out of the way because you really know your head bones right now and different processes and things like that. So the origin, again, is what? The more movable or less movable end of the muscle? The less movable end, so that's the sternum and the clavicle. So when that muscle contracts, the sternum and clavicle don't move. What part moves? It's the mastoid process, which is part of the temporal bone. So with both sternocleidomastoids, they're arranged bilaterally. That means that you have a left one and a right one. If they both contract, that's going to pull the mastoid process down to the clavicle and to the sternum. So that's flexion of the cervical neck. Right? If only one contracts, that's going to produce a rotation. Right? If the right one contracts, that's going to produce a right lateral rotation. If the left one contracts, that's a left lateral rotation. And if both contract, that's just plain old flexion. Okay. All right. So where do we see a muscle? Here's part of it here. All right. We can see part of it that is inserting into the mastoid process of the temporal bone. I don't see the origin. Where do we see an origin? Ah, here's a good view of the sternocleidomastoid. So here is the origin. Here's one origin on the manubrium. Here's the other origin on the clavicle. And they both come together with a common insertion on the mastoid process of the temporal bone. So when it contracts, it's going to pull the mastoid process down inferiorly to the clavicle and to the sternum right here. All right, so don't forget, when a muscle is doing its job, it is shortening. It's bringing bones together. Can never push on something. Okay. All right, well, since we're over in this part of the body, okay, so the sternocleidomastoid is anterior, and if you contract both of those, that causes flexion. Your head is going to be pointing down. How do you get your head back up straight again? What's going to happen? What do you have to do to get your head back up straight again? What kind of muscle do you have to use? You have to use an antagonistic muscle, right? Otherwise, you're out of luck. Okay, so the antagonistic muscle to the sternocleidomastoid, right, is the splenius capitis and the splenius cervicis right here. I think you might have to know the splenius capitis. All right, so again, the insertion is the mastoid process. And the origin is going to be the transverse processes of cervical vertebrae and maybe some spinous processes of the cervical vertebrae. All right, so it's going to be in an opposite body compartment, produce an opposite motion, namely, what do we call that motion by the splenius capitis? The motion of the splenius capitis is going to be antagonistic to the sternocleidomastoid. It's going to be extension of the vertebral column of the neck. Okay, so I like to introduce that concept of antagonism in the muscle system or the skeletal system even, because I think it's easier to understand muscle actions if you can link an action to some other kind of muscle rather than just learning a list of muscles and learning a list of actions. Okay, or just memorizing. I don't really want you to memorize necessarily. I want you to appreciate how the body is laid out. Okay, let's see. What about some other muscles? Okay, since we're on this slide right here, we have some scalenes. Okay, and the scalenes originate from the transverse processes of the cervical vertebrae, and they insert into these guys right here. What are these guys right here? Ribs. And which ribs are these? The first and second rib. Okay, and when that's right. And when these muscles contract, right, the neck doesn't move, but these ribs move, right? And these ribs are what? They are lifted up, right? And we're going to see when we get to the respiratory chapter, that's very important for inspiration, okay? When we exhale, our ribs are going to be depressed, compressing our thoracic cavity, decreasing the volume of our thoracic cavity. But when we inhale, we have to increase the volume of our thoracic cavity, and the scalenes help do that by help lifting the ribs. Plus other muscles are going to pull on these two ribs as well, and they're going to be lifted as a result. So the scalenes not only lift rib number 1 and 2, but they help lift all the ribs of the thoracic cavity. And we'll see what kind of muscles do that in just a little bit. So that's for inspiration. Scalenes are muscles of inspiration. All right, so let's look at some other muscles here. Trunk muscles. Rectus abdominis. Where would we find the rectus abdominis? Okay, the abdominal region, right? So anterior trunk. And what kind of muscle does it look like? It is a nice straight, yeah, flat muscle. It's a straight muscle. It's not deltoid in shape. Then that's, you get that from that term rectus right there. Okay, so let me see if I can find some trunk muscles here pretty quickly. All right, so here's a trunk, and here are some muscles in the anterior trunk or the abdomen, and these are the straightest muscles that you see right here. So these are the rectus abdominis right here. All right, so they have common, they have a set of common origins and insertions. Now when that muscle contracts, all right, what part of your body is going to move? If we analyze this muscle a little bit, let's analyze this muscle. When the rectus abdominis contracts, what's moving? What is the motion that's produced? Flexion of the vertebral column, right? Okay. So there are two points of attachment. One is going to be like the xiphoid process of the sternum, and the other attachment point is going to be the pubis, the pubic bone, which is the anterior pelvic bone. All right, so when this muscle contracts, does your pelvic bone move or does your sternum move? Okay, well, when mine contracts, my pubis is staying right where it is, and it's the sternum that's moving. So the sternum is what, the origin or the insertion? It's the insertion, okay. Okay, so most muscles in your body are arranged so that the origin is superior and the insertion is inferior. For instance, like the biceps, right? When the biceps contracts, it's the forearm that moves. But we've talked about two muscles where that rule is not followed. Namely what? The sternocleidomastoid, because the insertion is, in that particular case, superior to the origin. And then this is another example. The rectus abdominis is another exception to that rule because the origin is on the pubis and the insertion is on the xiphoid process. So if you're going to have to just guess on a test about origin and insertion, you just might want to guess that the insertion is going to be the inferior part of that muscle. But you're not guaranteed to always get that right. But that would always be a good guess, okay, for instance, on a test. Okay, upper limbs. Okay, biceps brachii. So the biceps has how many origins? Biceps, right? In the name it tells you there are two origins to that. There's a long head and a short head. That's what I have with this little nomenclature right here. O just stands for the first origin, and this double O right here means the second origin. So the origin of the long head is the supraglenoid tubercle. Can anybody remember where that supraglenoid tubercle is? What bone is it on? It's on the scapula, and it's going to be the superior margin of the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. You don't have a good picture in your book, but if in lab you rubbed your finger over the top of the glenoid fossa right there, you'd feel a little rough area. So that would be the origin of the long head of the biceps brachii, and the short head is the coracoid process. Where's the coracoid process? That's on the scapula as well, the thing that kind of looks like a little beak. It's the not the big process, that's the acromion process, but that other little process. So both kind of go across the shoulder as well, and the insertion is the radial tuberosity. What bone is the radial tuberosity on? Yeah, it's on the radius bone, right? They'd be, what, it's pretty close to the proximal epiphysis, right? It's on the superior part of the radius. And when the biceps brachii contracts, that's going to pull the radius up toward the scapula, right? The coracoid process and the glenoid fossa, and we call that motion flexion of the forearm. And the antagonistic muscle is the, in the opposite body compartment, is going to be the triceps brachii. Okay, since it's in the posterior arm, the long head is on the infraglenoid tubercle, And the lateral head is the proximal posterior shaft of the humerus, which is what, near the proximal is the more superior end of the humerus. The medial head is on the distal posterior shaft, so it's on the lower humerus. And the insertion is on the olecranon process of the ulna. Let's see if I can find a picture. I'm going the wrong way. I don't know if I have a picture of these. Close. Okay. Can it be? Here's... I don't have a good picture. Okay, but your book has a good picture of the biceps. Let's go back to over here. So here's the triceps. Okay, so the long head goes all the way up to the infraglenoid tubercle, which is underneath this muscle right here. Okay, and it inserts into the olecranon process of the ulna. So when this contracts, okay, that's going to extend the forearm. All right, so here is a really nice view of the biceps. You can see the long head going between the, or right through the intertubercular groove between the tubercles at the head of the humerus into the supraglenoid tubercle, and the short head goes to the coracoid process. And the insertion is the radial tuberosity. But here is another broad, flat tendinous sheath. This is what we call an aponeurosis, right? That just surrounds the forearm right here. And so the biceps inserts into just this general area right here. Okay. So that's how we're going to start looking at some muscles. And today we're supposed to look at muscles of the head. So let's go back and look at some of these head muscles and the trunk. So some muscles that we have to know. Okay, so we talked about the occipital frontalis. And let's talk about muscles of facial expression first. Facial expression. And is facial expression a very important kind of activity that you undergo in your daily life? Right. It's very important, right? Because it's not always what you say. It's what? It is how you say it that really matters, plus the facial expression that you use when you say something really connotates information to people. Okay, so muscles of facial expression are very important for communication. All right, so let's see, facial expression. Some circular muscles, like the orbicularis oculi around your eyes, orbicularis oris, right here. So what's the action of the orbicularis oculi? What kind of facial expression is that? Who does that? Closes your eyes, sort of, blinking like that maybe, but it could also be if you do one, that would be what? A wink, right? So that's your winking muscle. All right, but of course it also protects your eye as well. All right, orbicularis oris right here. That's important for a number of things, for speech, but also, what would we call that muscle? That would be for puckering your lips, right? You could call that a kissing muscle. But for eating, what else is that important for? If you have, for instance, if you have, your mother probably told you this when you were growing up, and you're chewing food, right? And you're chewing food without this orbicularis oris muscle, you chew that food, it just come popping right out of your mouth, right? So when you're really young, what were you told to do? Close your mouth when you chew. And so your mom really should have said, stimulate that orbicularis oris muscle. Okay? Well, you could do that later tonight if you wanted to. Orbicularis oris, that's that circular muscle here. Okay. Now, smiling muscles. What are some smiling muscles? The zygomaticus, right? The major and minor zygomaticus muscles, smiling muscle, and even to some extent the levator labii superioris. All right, but we want the muscles that go to the angle of the mouth more than just the upper lips, right? So the levator labii just helps open your lips, for instance, for breathing or for eating, drinking. Okay, levator labii superior. So what does labii mean? Lip. Labii is just a lip. Levator means it elevates the lip, and superioris just means that it is the it's the upper lip that gets elevated. Okay. Depressor anguli oris. This is a pouting muscle, right? That's a pouting muscle right here. It depresses the angle of the mouth. And here's a depressor labii inferioris. I guess could be another pouting muscle, okay, for lowering your lower lip. And, yeah. You know, I was thinking about that earlier today, and I'm going to have to do some research on the anguli oris, depressor anguli oris, because it's really hard to find on the muscle models upstairs. And, oh, your question was this, what was your question again? Oh, this one right here, the depressor anguli oris. Well, it depresses more the angle of the mouth, more so than the lip. So that's like a frowning, okay, kind of muscle. Okay.
What about the levator anguli oris?
The levator anguli oris. That's the one that, you know, I don't know if I can show you exactly where that is, but it's probably this one right in here. Okay. But it's going to elevate the angle of the lips. Okay, and that's the one that's really hard to find on the muscle models that you have in lab. So it's a smiling kind of muscle, right? Okay, so that's muscles of facial expression. And then, and I suppose you can use your occipital frontalis for facial expression to some degree too, like if you raise your eyebrows, if you're like really contemplating something, thinking about something, okay? Okay, and then, so that's facial expression. Then we have another group of muscles that we call muscles for mastication. And mastication just means chewing, right? And so we have a couple of motions for chewing. Of course, chewing is elevating the mandible, right? Chomping down, but we also have to be able to depress the mandible. And we also have to be able to grind back and forth. Okay, so all of those are motions of mastication, and then there are some accessory muscles to make sure that food doesn't pop out of your mouth, like what, the orbicularis oris muscle. And another muscle that's real important to just keep the food in the right position so that when you chomp down on it, it doesn't squirt out from underneath the teeth. Okay, and so that muscle that keeps food underneath the teeth when you're chewing is the buccinator. The buccinator compresses the cheeks so that the food stays underneath your teeth. So when you're grinding away, okay, that you can have an efficient motion. There are a couple muscles for elevating the mandible, and the prime mover probably is the masseter right here, as well as the temporalis. Okay, and I'm going to show you where the origins and insertions of the masseter and temporalis are. For depressing the mandible, okay, depressing the mandible, the digastric, okay, so here is the digastric for depressing, for opening the jaw, and one of the pterygoids also for lowering the jaw. So you don't need very strong muscles to depress the mandible, but you need strong muscles to what? Elevate the mandible. So let's take a look at some of these muscles right here. Okay, so here is, this is a free website that you can go to. Maybe you've run into this in lab already. It's called Get Body Smart, and it has different physiologic exercises on it and some anatomy exercises on it, but I'll probably email you this link so you can mess around on it over the weekend. And it might even be good for bones, if I haven't looked at the bone part yet. So for instance, let's look at the masseter. Okay. All right, so here we see the skull. Let's go back down over here. So we don't see any muscles right now. So here is what is this part of the skull right here? This is the zygomatic arch, right? So here's the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. Here's the zygomatic process of the temporal bone.
And the origin is the zygomatic arch, and the insertion is the lateral surface of the angle of the ramus, which is right here. So when this muscle contracts, can you see that it is going to just pull the mandible up to the zygomatic arch, or what we call elevate the mandible? So if we click on that, we can see what the motion is, right? Just elevation of the mandible. So this is really handy to see an isolated muscle and what kind of action that it produces. Plus, you can check yourself to see if you have a pretty good idea of where these origins and insertions are. Okay, and then the other thing is you can start to add different layers. Like, for instance, here is the origin of the masseter muscle. Here's the insertion of the masseter. And then we can fill it in like this. And then, okay, we can even look at some other muscles as well. But instead of looking at these other muscles right now, let me just go back to this list. The temporalis. Let's just look at the temporalis. So here I see the temporalis, and I'm going to bring this back down right over here. Okay, so the origin are these temporal lines in the temporal fossa, all right? And the insertion is the tip and medial surface of the coronoid process. Where's that coronoid process? Right here? Yeah, it's that sharp anterior process at the end of the ramus of the mandible. So this is the insertion. And so this is what? The more movable end of the muscle. And the action means when this muscle contracts, it's going to pull this part of the mandible, what? Superior, but also what? A little bit inferior. So it's going to cause elevation of the mandible. And what did we call that motion when you stick your jaw out? But be careful when you do this so you don't chip a tooth. That's protraction. And when you pull it in, that's retraction, right? So the temporalis also helps retract the mandible. So it elevates. The prime motion is elevation, okay, just like that. Okay, in this class and in lab, you don't have to know how these muscles are innervated. But if you are interested, this is a nice website that shows the innervation as well. Okay, so that's the... I haven't tried quiz. We could try quiz in a little bit. All right, so let's go back. What else do we have? The pterygoids. What part of your anatomy do these two muscles take you back to? The lateral and medial pterygoids. They're the part of the sphenoid bone, right? Those perpendicular plates in the sphenoid bone are the pterygoid processes. Okay, so let's take a look at these muscles and see what they do. So they're important for mastication. All right, so we're looking at the lateral pterygoids first. All right, so the let's look at the insertion and origins right here. So there is a superior head on the surface of the sphenoid bone, and the inferior head is the lateral surface of the pterygoid plate right here, and it inserts into, what is this? This is not the coronoid process. This is the condyle of the mandible. I didn't quite hear what you said. Okay, condyle of the mandible right here. So this is going to be the lateral pterygoid because it is on the outside, for instance. The medial pterygoids are going to be more on the inside or more medial. All right, so if we fill this in with muscle here, we can see the lateral pterygoids. And this is important because if... And again, you have these muscles on both sides of your face. If they work in unison, it's going to cause protraction of the mandible as well as help open your mouth. But if you only use one side, muscles on one side, it's going to move one side of the mandible more than the other, and it's going to cause grinding. And grinding is important for mastication, right? So not just chewing down, but for grinding, and that's what we have molars and even incisors for, is to grind food. Okay, so let's see. Action. Okay, moving, protruding, okay, as well as depressing the mandible. So it weakly depresses the mandible. All right, now what about the lateral pterygoids? Pretty much the same, I mean the medial pterygoids, pretty much the same kind of motion. I can't stop it. Okay. All right, so let's look at the origin. So it's going to be what? The origin is the medial surface of the lateral pterygoid plate. And the insertion is going to be the medial surface of the ramus and angle of the mandible. So it's not on the outside, it's what? The inside surface of the mandible. And when that muscle contracts, again, it's going to elevate. It's going to if both of them work together, that's going to elevate the mandible, and it is also going to protrude the mandible. Okay, so there's elevation. Here's protrusion. It weakly protrudes. And, I didn't show you this on the last one. But again, if you contract only one on one side, that's going to, what? That's going to move the mandible laterally. That's a grinding motion. So from side to side, here's a side to side view of what it's doing. Okay, side to side. All right, so those are some important muscles of mastication. Let me see if I can show you anything on this one right here. Okay, now this one you can't get online anywhere. Muscle actions. Okay, the action of the frontalis, which is what muscle? Right here? Okay, so if we stimulate this muscle right here, what's going to happen? You just see wrinkling of the forehead, right, and elevation of the eyebrows right here. Okay, so that's maybe not such a good temporalis. Would you agree this is temporalis right here? Okay, temporalis. I don't know if this is such a good next question. Don't have to know that one. Incorrect. I just want to go to the next question. These are all ones you don't have to know. Here's some that we know. Okay, so orbicularis, that's going to be a circular muscle around the eyes. Oh, oris. No, around the mouth. Next question. Trapezius. Well, we haven't gone over the trapezius. Okay, trapezius is here. Maybe I'll come back to this later. Okay. Let me just try something else. Okay, I could probably just ask you some questions. Okay, so these are superficial muscles. So this one right here, we haven't mentioned just yet. And this is just a very broad, flat muscle in your neck. And it depresses the mandible weakly. It pulls the mandible down. This is the platysma. That might ring a bell for some people. All right, and this one right here is the orbicularis oris. This is the orbicularis oculi. Here is the frontalis, right? If you want to say occipital frontalis or the frontal belly of the occipital frontalis. And what muscle is right here? There is no muscle right there. What is this thing? That's the Gallic aponeurosia, right? Broad flat tendinous sheath. And then right here is the zygomaticus major. Here is the zygomaticus minor.
Let's see what else we have right here. Looks like that's going to the superior lip, so that is the levator labii superioris. Okay, what other ones do we see? This is probably the masseter right here. And this deep one underneath the masseter, that's the buccinator. Okay. And then we see, we can check some of these things. Levator labii superioris, zygomaticus, okay, platysma. I think we did good on all of these. Buccinator, okay. Let's go to another deep layer right here. What are these right here? Sternocleidomastoid? What happens if I click? Sternocleidomastoid? I don't think you have to know this. Oh, depressor anguliaris. You do have to know that one. Okay. I don't think you have to know anguliaris, inferioris, mentalis, trapezius. These you don't have to know, but this one you might have to know. Thyroid. No, none of these you have to know. Nope. Okay, I'm going to have to play around with this one some more before it's useful for lecture. Okay, so that's the muscles for facial expression and for mastication. And we're going to look at some muscles of the trunk. So let's go to anterior trunk. Okay, and you can see the muscles that we were talking about that in your book as well. Okay, anterior, there's posterior trunk. There's some anterior. Okay, so anterior trunk muscles. We looked at the rectus abdominis right here. And then there are other muscles that are superficial to the rectus abdominis. And the most superficial is what we call the external oblique. And then the next deeper layer is the internal oblique. And the next deepest is the transverse abdominis. All right, so what are all of these going to do to one degree or another? These are, when they contract, flexion of the spinal cord. Okay. But they're also important, for instance, along with the rectus abdominis, for breathing, for either inspiration or expiration. But when those muscles contract, okay, they compress the abdominal contents, and that shoves those contents up into the thoracic cavity, thus forcing air out of your lungs. So all these muscles are important for expiration as well. All right, so don't forget the rectus abdominis and these three layers of the transverse and the oblique muscles. All right, now what about for extension of the vertebral column? What muscles, where would you look for muscles for extending the vertebral column? The posterior trunk. And there's only one muscle, you got hundreds of muscles back there, but there's only one muscle that I really want you to be aware of, and that is going to be, okay, the spinalis muscles. The erector spinae. All right, so all of these right here are erector spinae, and that's the only one that you have to know on this part of your body. Just call them erector spinae. So erector spinae, what's the action of the erector spinae? It's for extension of the vertebral column, because they're going to be antagonistic to the abdominal muscles. So those are easy to know. All right, another important muscle is the diaphragm. So the diaphragm is going to be found about in this location right here. And the diaphragm, that's just a top-down view, but if we look at, let's look at an anterior view. And here's the rib cage, so here are ribs, like this. Here's the sternum. The diaphragm
looks like this. Can you see that it's a different color? Yeah. Okay, so this is when it is relaxed. So what shape does the diaphragm have when it's relaxed? It is dome-shaped, okay, and it is dome-shaped and pointing up into the thoracic cavity. All right, when it's excited, what happens to the diaphragm? All right, so it's just going to pull together on these two ends, and it flattens out like this. I'm sorry? Yeah, it straightens out. It just goes straight across like this. So can you see that there is a change now in the thoracic, the volume of the thoracic cavity when it contracts? Because after it contracts, this is the increase in volume of the thoracic cavity. And when the volume changes like that, air flows into your lungs. So the diaphragm, the action of the diaphragm is a muscle of inspiration. Okay, muscle of inspiration. And we talked about some other muscles for, another muscle for inspiration because it helped elevate the rib cage. What were the muscles that elevated the rib cage? Right, the scalenes. At least rib number 1 and 2. Right? But there are some other muscles attached to ribs, namely the external intercostals. So an intercostal muscle is a muscle between the ribs, that's where the name comes from, and the external intercostals, when they contract, will pull the ribs superior. Right? So what happens to these ribs when the when those intercostals contract? The ribs are down over here, right? And now they come up over like this. They're elevated. They move up. So now the rib cage expands, right? Not just inferiorly, but it expands laterally, and the scalenes help the rib cage expand anteriorly as well. So the rib cage, when the external intercostals contract, the rib cage expands again, right? And when the rib cage expands, what happens? That is inspiration. So the external intercostals are for inspiration. The internal intercostals, on the other hand, when these contract, it pulls the ribs down. What happens when the thoracic cage contracts? That is expiration. All right, so the external intercostals are for inspiration and the internal intercostals are for expiration. And the other muscles that we talked about for expiration are what? Which ones were those? Muscles of expiration were the abdominal muscles because it compresses the abdominal contents that get forced up into the thoracic cavity, and that helps expel air for expiration. Okay. So what are some other muscles we want to look at? Muscles that act on the abdomen. Let's take a look at this. Okay, so we're looking at the external oblique, which is the most superficial muscle of the anterior muscles of the abdomen. And you can see that the origins are the ribs, the inferior ribs, and the insertion is the iliac crest right here, and that flexes the vertebral column. Right, just like the abdominis rectus does. Internal oblique. The internal oblique, the origin is the anterior iliac crest. The The insertion are the costal cartilages. All right, so when that moves, that's going to flex the vertebral column as well. And this can also rotate or laterally flex. For instance, if you just use a muscle on one side, you have these bilaterally, but if you use one on one side, that's going to cause a rotation. Okay, transverse abdominis. Okay, the origin is the anterior portion of the iliac crest, and the insertion is the abdominal aponeurosis to the linea alba. Now, what is an aponeurosis again? It's a broad, flat tendinous sheath, and I'll show you that aponeurosis in a little bit. And also the linea alba, right? That's another tendinous area along the rectus abdominis. Okay, so that compresses the abdomen for, what happens when you compress the abdomen? That is expiration, okay? Okay, so where is the abdominal aponeurosis? So here is the abdominal aponeurosis, this white material right here. And this white line right down the middle is the linea alba. Right, so these are tendinous materials that connect the stomach muscles together. Okay, so the posterior trunk, anterior trunk. I think that's really what we wanted to look at today. So let's look at some, let's move on to some muscles of the shoulder, for instance. Serratus anterior. So here is the serratus anterior, and we're looking, this is an anterior view. Okay, so the origin is the anterior surfaces of the superior ribs, 1 through 8. Okay, and the insertion is the anterior surface of the medial border of the scapula. So where do these serratus anterior muscles go? They wrap all the way around the lateral side of the thoracic cage, and they insert into the anterior surface of the medial border of the scapula, right here. So here's the serratus anterior. So you can see it acting on the scapula. And so it abducts the scapula and rotates the scapula upward. Let's see if we can see what that motion looks like. All right, so that is what? Moving away from midline, that is abduction. Moving toward midline is adduction. Okay, so the serratus anterior is a muscle that helps fixate the scapula in position. So it's a fixator. Okay, pectoralis minor. Let's take a look at the pectoralis minor. The origin are the anterior surfaces of the sternal ends of ribs 3 through 5, and the insertion is the coracoid process of the scapula, and it draws the scapula forward and downward. So again, it's a fixator as well. Okay, so just remember that when the muscle contracts or when it's excited, it can only shorten, and it's going to bring these two bones together. All right, so it draws the scapula forward anteriorly and downward as well. levator scapulae. You probably have to know this one. Here's the levator scapulae. The origin are the transverse processes of C1 through C4. The insertion is the medial border, right, between the spine of the scapula and the superior angle. So when this muscle contracts, can you see that the scapula is going to be elevated? So this is a fixator on the scapula. Trapezius. So the origin is the superior nuchal line and external protuberance on the occipital bone. The ligamentum nuchae, which is a ligament that comes from that same area, as well as all the spinous processes from C7 all the way down to T12. So it's a very long origin. And the insertion is the clavicle, so it's the anterior side of your trunk, as well as the posterior side, the spine of the scapula. So the action is going to be elevate and upwardly rotate the scapula when it contracts. Upwardly rotate. And it can also extend the neck. And the rhomboideus muscles, the action is very, very similar. So I'll just show you one of them. Okay, so the rhomboideus major is here, the minor is up over here. The origin is the spinous processes of T2 through T5, and the insertion is the medial border. This is a fixator, but it's a fixator of the scapula. It will adduct, right, because it's going to pull the scapula medially. Okay. And if these lower units down here contract, it's going to elevate the scapula. I want to find a shoulder. Okay, the deltoid muscle. So the origin is the anterior portion of the clavicle, right, and the acromion process. And the insertion right here is the deltoid process of the humerus. So that's the deltoid, and when that muscle contracts, that's going to abduct, right, the arm, right? But if the anterior portion of the deltoid contracts by itself, right, if just the anterior portion contracts, your humerus is going to be moved anteriorly. What is this motion? This is a hard motion to see, to remember, as opposed to this one. If you look at the hip, what is my hip doing? The hip is flexing, okay, and when the humerus moves in that same sense, the arm is being flexed. So this is flexion and extension. So the deltoid, okay, flexes the arm. So that's flexion. Okay, the middle part abducts, which is that motion right there, abduction. Okay. Pectoralis major. Is this muscle right here? So the origin is the medial half of the clavicle and the sternum, and the insertion is the lateral lip of the intertubercular groove, and the crest right below the greater tubercle. So when this muscle shortens, right, it's going to flex, right, it's going to pull the humerus anteriorly, that's flexion, but it's also going to cause a medial rotation, and it can also pull your arm into your side. It can adduct all those different motions. Pectoralis major, so it's the prime mover for forearm flexion. Okay, so prime mover for forearm flexion, what muscle would produce the opposite kind of motion? What's the opposite of flexion? Extension of the arm. Let's see if I can find the extender. It's not going to be in this group. Ah! Okay, so here is okay. The latissimus dorsi. The origin would be spines of the thoracic vertebrae. Okay. And the insertion of the latissimus dorsi. Let's see if we can find the insertion. Okay, the insertion is right at the base of the intertubercular groove. And that intertubercular groove is on the anterior side of the humerus. So when this muscle contracts, okay, it's going to pull the anterior side of the humerus posteriorly. What is that motion? That is extension. So latissimus dorsi extends. And if you put your arms above your head, okay, and you move your arms back down by your side, what's that motion? This is flexion. What is this motion? This is extension, right? So when you try to do, for instance, a pull-up or a chin-up, what muscle is extending your arm or bringing it back down to your sides? Okay, well, the biceps will be flexing, lifting yourself up. Okay, but what is, so the biceps is going to do this motion here, all right, but what is going to move your arm back down to your side when you're doing a pull-up? Okay, so that is the latissimus dorsi that does that, right? That's extension. That's this motion, okay, which is the same as this if it is, if your arm is flexed to begin with. Okay, let's look at some other muscles that work across the shoulder, like the supraspinatus. All right, the supraspinatus you should find in the supraspinous fossa. Okay, so here is the spine of the scapula, and here's the supraspinous fossa, here's the infraspinous fossa. So this is the supraspinatus. The origin is the, well, it's the whole fossa, that's the origin, and the insertion is the greater tubercle of the humerus. So when this muscle contracts, that's going to, all right, that's going to pull that, it's going to rotate the head of the humerus and pull your arm laterally. That is what we call abduction. So abduction, the infraspinatus is going to be in the infraspinous fossa, right here. So the origin is the infraspinous fossa, and the insertion is the greater tubercle again. And when this muscle contracts, it's not going to lift the humerus up, but it's just going to cause a rotation of the humerus, a lateral rotation, right? It's going to pull the posterior part of the humerus toward midline. That's a lateral rotation. And I think I mentioned lateral rotation last time, as being an important kind of motion that gets when your shoulder is damaged in a certain way, you can't laterally rotate. What was that? That was called a rotator cuff injury. Right? So here is one of the muscles. You can see that it goes across the shoulder joint, and it actually participates and helps form part of the fibrous capsule that forms the shoulder joint right here. And so any damage to the shoulder joint, right, we call that a rotator cuff injury. And the muscles that contribute to rotator cuff are what we call sits. So the muscles that make up the rotator cuff are the supraspinatus, the infraspinatus, and the T stands for teres. And you just have to remember there are a couple of teres muscles. There's a major and a minor. It's the teres minor. And this last one over here is the subscapularis. Muscles. These are muscles that make up the rotator cuff, because they all work across the shoulder. So let's see if we can find a... teres minor. All right, so if we look at this diagram here, we can see the triceps and the deltoid and the trapezius, right, the teres major. Now, where's the teres minor? Teres minor is right here. So the origin is the middle part of the lateral border of the scapula, and the insertion is the greater tubercle of the humerus, right, that laterally rotates the humerus. What about the, we did the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, I don't have a subscapularis. Okay, so where's the subscapularis at? All right, so here's pectoralis major. So we're looking at an anterior view, right, of the shoulder, anterior view. So let's get some of these muscles out of the way. All right, and so here is the subscapularis. Now, what part of the scapula is the subscapular fossa on? It's on the anterior side. So we're looking at the anterior side of the scapula right here. All right, so here is the origin. It's a subscapular fossa. That's the anterior side of the scapula. And the insertion is the lesser tubercle of the humerus. And when that muscle contracts, it's going to pull the anterior side of the humerus, right, toward midline, which is going to cause a medial rotation. So if I click right here, okay, you can see a medial rotation. Okay, another fun muscle to take a look at is the coracobrachialis. That's this little muscle right in here. The coracobrachialis, the origin is a coracoid process. The insertion is this mid-medial surface of the humerus. Okay, so hence, again, the muscle is just named by the origin and the insertion. And when this muscle contracts, what is that going to do? The coracoid process is pretty anterior. That's going to weakly flex. It's going to weakly flex the arm, but it's also going to pull the arm into the side. We call that adduction. So flexion, all right, and adduction, both of those motions. Coracobrachialis. Okay, let me go to the list of things that I wanted to show you today. All right, so we covered muscles of facial expression, muscles of mastication, neck flexion, extension would be the splenius capitis, elevating the ribs would be the scalenes. Here, vertebral column extension would be erector spinae. Flexion will be abdominal muscles. And muscles of respiration for breathing. Okay, the rectus abdominis, internal oblique for compressing the abdominal compartments for expiration. What about for inspiration? What are some muscles for inspiration? That would be the diaphragm. Inspiration would be the external intercostals and the scalenes. And the internal intercostals help for expiration as well. Okay, so that's it for muscles that we're going to look at today.